Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Welcome in. You are listening to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck, and I'm your host for the full 2 hours this weekend. That's right. Big Al is taking a little break from KER Politics, so that means you are going to get 2 hours of metals and markets commentary. The first hour is going to be focused more on the metal sector, along with a update from Novo Resources to wrap up the first hour, and the second hour more focused on general markets, as well as I know I'm going to be getting a lot of comments on the Fed and what came out of that press conference and statement midway through last week. Happy to say that I am kicking off this show with Rick Rule. Everybody knows Rick Rule, but more importantly, you know what? He comes over from Sprott, who has been very active in the resource sector over these last couple years. One of the few groups that has been injecting, I think, key portions of money into stocks. Let's first take a look from the high level at the precious metals, gold more specifically, and it's set up in 2019. We are in a bit of an uptrend, but quite frankly, that middle to tail end of the year last year was rough on gold until it managed to bottom in October. Where do you think the precious metals stand right now in your eyes here, Rick?
My own suspicion is that we are in for a good, but perhaps not great, 2019 from a gold pricing standpoint. I think we're in the early parts of a rollover of the U.S. dollar. I think the fact that the Fed has decided that they're going to be patient, which is a buzzword for soft, means that the strength that the dollar has enjoyed relative to some other currencies, and specifically with regards to gold, probably begins to roll over in 2019, which is good for gold. You've heard me say on your show for years that the gold price is importantly a manifestation of people's faith in the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar. In other words, they trade conversely. If the yield on the U.S. 10-year treasuries doesn't actively reflect people's suspicion with regards to the purchasing power, that is, the depreciation of their purchasing power, then the treasury falls and gold does well. And I think we're in the very beginnings of that move right now. The levels of debt we have, which don't seem to bother people anymore, still bother people who can do arithmetic. The idea that at the federal level we owe $22 trillion in recourse obligations and $130 or $140 trillion in non-recourse obligations, over time, that number begins to weigh on people's faith in the ability of the U.S. dollar to maintain its purchasing power. And as that wavering of faith gains strength, the gold price will gain strength too.
So this year, it sounds like more of a development on the positive side for the precious metals as more things start to go in their favor. But again, kind of what you said there is don't necessarily expect a screaming higher gold price, just more of this building to better data. What do you have to say about some of that recent information coming out of other central banks that they have started buying gold? I know a lot of the gold bugs hang on to this kind of data and say this is really going to pop the gold price. I think it's more about the generalist investor finally showing some interest. How do you balance the two?
I agree with you completely. My friend Doug Casey once described central bankers as people who might have trouble finding jobs at convenience stores had they not been born into good families and worn good suits. The idea that they're particularly savvy investors, I think, has been disproven fairly conclusively over time. The sales by the Canadian and British central banks of gold early in the last decade before it rose sixfold in price being prime examples. I'm more impressed, frankly, by private sector investors who have had very good track records over the last 30 years, the sort of Ray Dalios of the world, and their buying of gold. And their buying of gold for the right reason, not because they're expecting immediate speculative gains, but rather because gold seems to them like a store of value in a very uncertain time. I take some heart in extremely smart people who have made billions of dollars with their own efforts, rather than the sort of blatherings of central bankers whose job it is to serve a sort of a homogenous and not so smart electorate.
A lot of these central bankers seem to deal with a lot of this groupthink, and they all seem to read off of similar playbooks, which seems to get them in the problems that they're in right now. But Rick, what about this overall trend of everybody getting very pessimistic in terms of the markets? We have seen we are in bear markets in markets around the world, and even many of the major markets in the U.S. dropped that 20% plus level just at the tail end of last year. How concerned do precious metals investors need to be of a major pullback in global equity markets also dragging down the precious metals?
I think that precious metals and precious metals equities investors need to be concerned from two different points of view. In particular, and I'm not saying it's going to happen, but we need to be concerned about a liquidity event, about a black swan, some unforeseen circumstance coming into a market where people were already afraid, a situation analogous to 2008. When you have liquidity-driven events, tertiary assets, which is to say small stocks and precious metals, get sold off very, very hard. We need to remember that gold stocks are stocks. And when you have an overall decline in the stock market, the gold stocks fall too. Now, they sometimes come back more quickly as a consequence of their underpinnings with regards to value. But gold stocks are stocks. The second thing that you and I need to recognize is that the audience listening to this, while they respond to gold, are normally broader-based natural resource investors. People who are gold investors are often intrigued by a variety of sort of hard money or natural resource topics. And the circumstance that would seem to be causing the major equity markets to sell off have to do with the fear that after 9 years of relatively benign economic climate, that is a recovery, however tepid, that recovery is long of tooth. And if we dip into recession on a global basis, particularly if we were to dip into recession in the United States, that would impact demand for a wide variety of commodities, and of course, impact pricing on commodities equities. So I think we need to be nervous both from a general market liquidity point of view and also from a broader economic point of view as resource investors and as investors in general.
And that's a whole nother reason for always having some sort of cash, being able to take advantage of any big drops in these stocks rather than being fully invested, especially in still an environment where there are a lot of question marks and nothing is perfect or for sure for a precious metals rise. Can we get just a quick comment from you before we get into some of the nuances within the actual stocks on some of the other resource sectors? Base metals continue to struggle. That can be a lot because of global growth. Energy metals really came off the burn last year. Do you see any of these starting to capture some more attention?
We see in the subsectors uranium definitely catching a bid, definitely catching interest. The base metals stocks have been really, really, really hurt. It appears that there are definitely supply deficits and supply deficits mounting, but people are concerned about the economy and about demand for various base metals looking 2 to 3 years out. It's a really interesting conundrum to me in base metals. You have major base metals, copper, zinc, I would argue, nickel, that are all priced in global markets below the incentive prices necessary to bring new mines into production. So we are living as a society on resources that come from mines that are very long of tooth, discovered 40 years ago, put into production 25 years ago. So at some point in time, and I can't tell you when, My suspicion is that we begin to have a series of rolling supply stocks, which will benefit base metals. But could that time be 2 years from now, or 3 years from now, or 4 years from now? An eternity for young or younger micro-cap stock speculators is the open question. From my point of view, I've always found my own portfolio to benefit from buying very high-quality mineral deposits, irrespective of market. You know, if you look back at the lessons we learned over the last 10 years, which were, of course, extraordinarily harsh, while that happened, great deposits, which are rare, but I'm thinking now of Timok with reservoir minerals, in a market that declined by probably 90%, I'm talking about the overall junior resource index, reservoir, of course, went from 45 cents to a $7 or $8 takeover by Nevsun, which was itself subsequently taken over. So one message I would leave people with is really irrespective of your outlook in the near term for metals markets, concentrate your efforts when they're available on very, very, very good deposits. And then let time work for you as opposed to working against you.
That's a very good comment, and in all fairness, that's been something that's been working even in these slow metals markets, is being extraordinarily selective in terms of the stocks that you invest in. Can I get your comment on how generally stocks, metal stocks, have been lagging even, let's say, the gold price? We're still seeing maybe too many stocks in general in the gold sector, and just a lack of capital flowing into a wide range of these stocks. How do you balance out a rising gold price and stock prices that are still at some pretty depressed levels?
That's a wonderful question, and I think partially it reflects skepticism on the part of the investment community, both the generalist community and the specialist community, about the structure of the gold mining industry. You put your finger on one criticism, which is to say that there are too many mining companies, majors, intermediates, juniors, and explorers, and that is being helped by the recent trend to mergers and acquisition. But the truth is that the industry spends too much money on listing costs and general and administrative costs. And the investors are wise to this. The investors are looking at the index and how much money goes out in G&A and how little money goes in the ground. And some of them are saying, wisely, I think, if you think the gold price is going to go up, buy gold. Buy the gold stocks later. The second reason for this malaise in gold equities relative to the gold price, I think, has to do with the experience of the last decade. And that's very damning for the gold industry. The gold price in the period 2000 to 2010, that decade, went from about $260 an ounce to $1,500 an ounce. And cash flow per share among the gold producers fell. Now, that took special skill to use a circumstance where the commodity that you produced increased sixfold in price while delivering a decrease in cash flow per share. And I think the industry is going to have to show investors that they aren't going to repeat those mistakes. I have some faith that they won't repeat those mistakes unless they're given the opportunity to. So in that regard, the malaise, the softness in the gold equities relative to the gold price is probably in the longer term useful, because it will temper the enthusiasm of management teams to do stupid things with money.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And unfortunately, and it is so unfortunate that even through this bear market, so many people have talked about the need for companies to be run more efficiently and more effectively. And now we're still seeing them make the same errors they were making 8 to 10 years ago. Let's look a little bit on the bright side, though, in terms of some of the M&A activity that has happened more at the top end, some of these majors, and especially just recently with Newmont and Goldcorp, and there's been a number of majors combining forces. Where do you see the opportunity coming here? Do you think that's going to lead to more acquisitions of the smaller companies, or is there another area where you see other companies being able to take advantage of some of the gap that's left?
I see three circumstances, all good. The first is that the lateral mergers by large companies gives them the ability to manage more assets with lower general and administrative expense. In other words, cutting G&A out of these businesses. Newmont has suggested that there could be as much as $100 million in savings. I suspect that there could be $250 million in savings, which would be good. The second thing is that we've proven over time that larger, more liquid companies enjoy higher share prices and lower cost of capital. And in a capital-intensive business like mining, that's a great competitive advantage. So one of the things that will happen, I think, is that it is, as you have fewer entities among the larger companies, that the share prices generally, represented probably by the XAU, will go up over 12 months for no other reason than more participants are larger and more liquid. There will also, I think, be a reasonable number of peer-to-peer mergers rather than takeovers, as institutional investors see the savings that they enjoyed in the majors and ask other parts of their portfolio to deliver them similar benefits. What I think will happen in the near term that investors won't like as much is that the takeovers that all of us suggested would happen in 2019, where larger companies took over smaller companies, will be less prevalent. The truth is that as a consequence of the Newmont and Barrick mergers, and to a lesser degree, the acquisition of Tahoe by Pan American, there's going to be $10 or $12 or $13 billion worth of assets for sale in the next 12 months, which I think will capture a lot of the cash that would otherwise have gone into takeovers. One area that really interests me, I guess two areas that interest me. The first is that the providers of capital to the industry, the people who will have to find the $12 billion for the acquirers, should do very well. That's a particularly happy event for me at Sprott because that's one of the businesses that we're in. And I suspect that the provision of capital, as an example, bridge lending for merger and acquisition activity in 2019 will be very good. I think the other beneficiaries of this that come immediately to mind will be the royalty and streaming companies, the Franco-Nevadas, the Wheaton Precious, the Anglo-Pacifics, the Sandstorms, the Royal Golds. People have been wondering if those companies could continue to grow their asset bases and deploy capital as rapidly as they have done in the past. And I think this year will be an absolute banner year for them deploying capital in these M&A activities. And the consequence of that deployment is that analysts and investors will be able to model out revenue growth on a per share basis for these companies over the next 5 or 6 years. So I think one of the immediate beneficiaries of this will be the royalty and streaming companies, which are already good businesses and have suffered some share price declines in 2018, making them more attractive investment targets anyway. The second circumstance that I think occurs for investors out of these dispositions will be the fact that more assets and more management teams are available. And I think what you'll see is some of the better juniors being able to acquire assets from these dispositions that they are able to focus on, and also round out their human resources team from high quality people who were able to make less of an impact at Barrick or at Newmont or at Randgold, or at Goldcorp, than they will be in the juniors. I remember some years ago when Barrick took over Placer Dome, the amount of intellectual capital that was dropped down into the junior sector positively impacted the junior sector, particularly in Vancouver, for 2 or 3 years. In our particular case at Sprott, we were able to hire Andy Jackson and Dr. Neil Adshead, who made an immediate difference in the performance of Sprott for its shareholders and for its investors. And I would expect this infusion of intellectual capital to make a real difference in the junior market over the next 2 or 3 years.
All right, Rick, some very interesting comments and some, I think, good focus for investors to look at the opportunities that are going to be present after these mergers and acquisitions are all completed and some of these people and properties start to get offloaded. Rick, it's great having you on the show. I greatly appreciate all of the time that you spend with us, and hey, I greatly appreciate all of your comments. I hope you have a great weekend, and thanks again for your time.
Certainly a pleasure, Corey. Thank you.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Welcome back, continuing to listen to the first hour of the weekend edition. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments that I spent with Rick Rule. It had been a while since I had Rick back on the show, but always interesting to see how he's viewing the metals market and more or less what's going on around the world. In this segment, I am introducing a new guest to the show. His name is Luis Garcia. He is the founder of the blog called High Grade by Economic Alpha. Economic Alpha is his Twitter handle. And I've been following Luis on Twitter for a number of years now, as he's provided some very good insights on specific companies and generally the resource sector. Luis, I first just want to introduce you by getting a general comment on the gold market. You focus on resources, but even more so on precious metals and gold. Can you outline some of the major drivers behind what's going on in gold right now and where you think gold stands in terms of an investment, please?
Sure. Thank you for that wonderful introduction. You know, the gold market right now is very interesting. Parallels to 2016, I think. For one, in 2016, the Fed paused, and it caused a significant rally in the price of gold. But back then, the price of gold was much lower. It was sub 1,100, I believe, if I recall correctly. This time around, 3 years later, we have a scenario where the Fed again has paused, and a lot of speculation is in the market right now that the Fed's next move could be not a hike, but rather a cut. So that's somewhat transformational. And so what I think where we stand right now, we're still in a very large trading range. Obviously, we're now at the higher end of that trading range. The trading range that I'm specifically referencing is the 1050 low and the 1370 high that we've been in for such a long time here. But I find it interesting that the parallels of 2016 are very similar, with the biggest difference being that I think the market is pricing in the end of the rate hike cycle. Whereas in 2016, hindsight's 2020, obviously, but that was really only a pause in the hike cycle. It went on to further continue, and so gold just kind of stayed in a trading range. But we're now $50 away from a level where if gold can break on a daily, weekly, and monthly closing basis, it'll get very interesting really fast.
Yeah, you outlined some good facts about where the Fed stands right now, and it's something that Chris Temple and I chatted about a lot over the week on Wednesday and Thursday specifically. But as you mentioned, gold has been in this trading range ever since 2013. You can argue that it's a long basing formation because we have been building out of that low that was put in at the tail end of 2015, but we still haven't gotten that breakout. Do you think just enough of the Fed pausing and continuing a pause throughout this year that can drive gold to finally break out of that pretty staunch resistance around 1370 to 1380?
Yeah, I hate using the or despise using the word this time is different, but it just seems to me that this time may be actually different. You know, we have a lot of different drivers this time around. We've got an economic cycle that is approaching or well beyond now 10 years. It's one of the longest economic cycles that we have been. And also real interest rates, a big driver in the price of gold. And actually the value of the dollar has been really struggling. You can kind of see gold in other currencies rallying significantly. And that's often a sign, especially when gold and other currencies are close to or nearing highs, for example, in the Australian dollar and also in the Canadian dollar, commodity currencies. We're not too far off from all-time highs in those respective currencies. And for the most part, in my view, the alternative currencies outside of the dollar typically rally first. And then the dollar, as the dollar starts to weaken, catches up from a gold price perspective. One of the other things too, and this has been well known, it's not new this year, but there was an article by the World Gold Council that was actually put out today that central bank gold buying has been the highest it's been in 50 years. The demand is there. It's not going away. So certainly, you know, this time around, you know, it's the product is difficult to value because it's very psychological. And that's why you have to focus on the technicals in addition to everything else to sort of see where the price can go from here.
I completely agree. Looking at the charts is crucial, and I know talking to a lot of the generalist investors, they're still waiting for that breakout to put more money into, or to put any money into the sector, which is a major driver when that does happen. Let's also talk about some stocks, but more stocks on a broad sense, because as I said, you follow a number of different, which I even believe are high quality stocks. The argument can be made that the stocks are still relatively lagging the overall gold price. As close as gold is to breaking out, the stocks still have, if you just judge it by GDX or GDXJ, still a lot of work to do to the upside. What are your comments about the general underperformance in terms of the stocks compared to what gold's been doing?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the issues in the mining sector are not entirely related to the price of gold. You know, unfortunately, a lot of the bad decisions that were made leading up to the gold price peak with buying assets at extraordinarily high valuations. I mean, let's face it, it's predominantly a cyclical industry for the most part. And, you know, the worst decisions in the cycle were made towards the end of the peak. And so a lot of folks are still working off those excesses. We're starting to see signs of change, though. Companies are starting to merge. The idea that it's the mining sector is just very fragmented. There's so many mining companies out there, some with just one property, some with just two, some with just hopes of having a property. There's just so many different mining companies out there. You know, the top three to four mining companies, you know, they don't own a majority of the mines out there. So it's a very, very fragmented sector. And so consolidation, especially in an environment where gold might actually be working to move higher, is very positive. But I think a lot of the lagging mining stocks have to do with just time passing by since the mistakes were made in the past. You know, it's interesting because there aren't many mining companies that are profitable at this gold price, if you look at it from a free cash flow perspective. And that's really what generates value because it's a very capital intensive sector. a lot of capital needs to be used to sustain the mines, but then you also need capital to explore and find reserves, because eventually, if you don't find reserves, you're going to deplete them or you have to buy something. And so at this point in the cycle, $1,300 gold is getting better, but a lot of mining companies still aren't generating free cash flow. Or if they are, it's not substantial enough to really put a fire in the industry.
Hey, I completely agree. I think one thing that you're really getting at is the fact of the matter is there's still a lot of mismanaged companies out there and a lot of companies that don't even have a whole lot of hope in them. It's unfortunately something that I saw at some of these recent conferences is that the good companies are few and far between, but there are some good companies out there, which takes us to kind of your investment strategy. It's something I find very interesting, something I've learned more about chatting with you off mic, and that deals with really focusing on a smaller number of companies that meet a pretty defined criteria. You're not necessarily looking for those high-risk exploration companies. You look at these companies more from a fundamental business perspective. Can you share some of the highlights and some of the key factors you look at when analyzing companies?
Sure. So as I just stated, the sector is so fragmented that there are so many different mining companies out there. And sometimes it's overwhelming. We see GDX and GDXJ and how they have really underperformed poorly. Even when compared to the price of gold, they have just underperformed poorly. And that to me means that, you know, there's just too many mining companies and even fewer that are actually investable mining companies. Sure, if the price of gold enters a bull market, mining companies are going to rise. They're leveraged to the price of gold, and so they're really call options to a higher gold price. But the way I looked at it was, if I wanted exposure to the price of gold, I could either buy the metal itself, or I could buy call options to the price of gold, or futures, or whatever the case may be to get that leverage. I don't really need to be in the mining sector. So when I looked at the mining sector as a whole, I realized to myself, if I'm going to invest in the sector, I want to rule out the price of gold from the beginning. And that's how I started my process. So really what I look for is a junior company that has potential to grow in the next 3 to 5 years, that has more than one asset so that I don't have a single asset mine risk, that can generate or is currently generating free cash flow to fund exploration, in other words, future growth and resources, that has a solid management team, one that has had success in the past at other companies in making money, and a company that has a proven track record and that has management skin in the game. So those are kind of the high level things that I look at. So at any given time, I may only be looking at, you know, 3 to 5 mining companies that I think are legitimate investments. And then the rest of them to me are just, you know, speculative leverage trades on gold, which is fine too, because I don't mind buying a mining stock that is going to double if the price of gold does really well. But that price doubling may never necessarily mean that that's what it's worth. Obviously, if you sell it after it doubles, then that's great. But a lot of times they double and maybe even triple, and they may not ever produce a mine or may never even produce an ounce of gold. And so that's why I'd rather focus on 5% of the industry and 95% of the rest I just trade.
I think that's a great strategy and one that I think many investors in this junior sector could learn from. It also would, I think, help to clear out some of these companies that don't really have a whole lot going for them that seem to somehow be able to raise small amounts of money just to keep the lights on. You did recently post an update on Atlantic Gold Corp on your website. That is economicalpha.blog. I will direct everybody to your website to read over that nice encompassing write-up that you have there on Atlantic. Are there any other companies that are catching your eye in that small selection of companies that you focus on?
Yeah, I mean, I've been pretty open about Westome and what they're doing there with the Eagle River asset, financing their future growth plans. Not only do you have an asset in Ontario that is currently generating free cash flow, but it's high grade and it's paying for the growth in the asset in Val-d'Or in Kiena. And what I like about Kiena is the prospective nature of the property. They have hit some really high grade drill results that are significantly different than what was ever mined there. And that to me is an eye-opening feature, and one that I think is going to lead to the restart of that mine, increase in reserves and resources, higher grade, and a mine that I think can be in production for a very long time. So it fits my strategy. I will say that I had purchased West Ohm in May at $155 US to Canadian, and it has since gone significantly higher. So I'm sitting on a nice decent profit on that one. It has run quite a bit. There's, I believe, still more value to create there, and I'm long on that name.
All right, Lewis, we are going to wrap it up there, but it's been great introducing you and having you on our show. I'm sure that I will be having you back on a more regular basis to discuss some more of the companies that you are liking and some more thoughts on the general market. Again, if anybody wants to check out Lewis's site, that is economicalpha.blog. I will also post a link in the weekend show posting. And if anybody has any questions for Lewis and you want him to look into any companies or any other topics regarding the precious metals, please just email me, fleck@kereport.com. Lewis, thanks again for your time and have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too. Thanks for having me on. I'll be more than happy to come back.
All right, welcome back here to wrap up the first hour of the weekend edition. As promised, we are getting that update from Novo Resources and Quentin Henny, the president and chairman. Quentin, on Thursday, January 31st, Novo released a news release that discussed this mechanical sorting that is ongoing at Karratha, and it outlined some encouraging results. I got a number of questions and some that were directed at the just clarification of what these type of results mean for the company. Can you please just first and foremost try to simplify what these results mean and help the investors understand what this means for the company moving forward?
Yeah, certainly. Look, we're very encouraged by the results. Back in December, we announced the results from the concentrates that were produced. Those were the first to be assayed. Then we got all the assays for the various fractions of material that was not picked by the machine. You know, in other words, we'll call it waste products and stuff, and then the undersized and the oversized fractions. So now we have a total look at the entire system, you know, the sorting recoveries and ability of this machine to potentially concentrate the gold out of these rocks. TOMRA usually uses, or ore sorting is usually used, I should say, for upgrading ore bodies. You know, like if people mine a deposit, the machines will pick out pieces of waste, and they might remove, say, 20 or 30% of the mass and upgrade the resulting material. That's typical, okay? In this case, we're actually picking the rock particles that have the gold, which is interesting. So we're taking a large mass of material, i.e. our conglomerates, crushing them down, putting them through a sorting machine, and the machine is actually picking out the rock particles that have gold in them, all right? This is a bit different approach, but it's not conventional. Like TOMRA has done this on several ore bodies. They said this is the first time they've seen recoveries like this. And it's by and large because of the deposit we have. You know, it's a very nuggety system. The gold occurs as discrete particles, bit of halo around them, but most of the gold occurs as nuggets within the rock. All right, so what does this mean? We crushed four samples. Two of them were a bit oxidized. They were kind of crumbly. Hindsight, you know, those were probably not the best samples to run, but we have limited access, you know, where we're at surface right now. So we have to kind of take what we can get. But the two samples that were indurated, like hard material, and we crushed them down, they sorted very well. We saw recoveries north of 80% in both of those in the product that was actually put through the machine. So I think one was 81%, one was 89%. This is remarkable. Think of it like this. What if you chucked a bunch of pennies in a cement mixer, and then the cement is poured out, and you're like, oh, I want my pennies back, right? So what are you going to do? you've got to crush up that rock and then extract those pennies, but they're randomly scattered through there. Put it through this machine. What's remarkable, this machine will get your pennies back, and it'll identify those particles of rock and recover those specific pieces. Okay, that's absolutely mind-blowing. Where we now need to move with this is we need to optimize things. We need to figure out what's an appropriate crush size so that the machine works more effectively. In other words, probably a bit finer, like we have to crush it down to, say, 50 millimeter particle size, so the X-rays can pass through the rocks and the machine can identify them. We also have to figure out what to do with the fines. We have some ideas, for example, a process called agglomeration. You take the fines and mix them with a little bit of cement, make them kind of like cookie dough, make them back into rock particles and put them through the sorter. That's one alternative. The other alternative is simple. You just process the fines through a gravity circuit, recover the gold out that way. All right, so what it means to us is we have a potential means now of processing this material, both at a test scale and, you know, ultimately, hopefully at a commercial scale. So we're moving in the right direction.
So, Quentin, just a follow-up. With this rock sorting and its success, or at least it seems like success, does this help you get to a resource report, or is this more for future test mining?
This is for future test mining as well as, you know, longer term. This is one of those things we wanted to test because of this unusual ore body. It worked. It looks like it's working, and we anticipate using it going forward. It will also be a component of our mineralization report that we're putting together right now on the project. I think showing that we have means to treat this material or potential means is really building us a case to convert our exploration licenses to mining licenses.
All right, Quentin. So there were a number of questions that came in from our listeners, and we will take at least a couple of them throughout this interview, but there were a lot of them. One question came from asking, what part of the conglomerate, the upper or the lower part, were these four samples taken from?
Yeah, we grabbed the first three samples. The first one was lower conglomerate, kind of right in the, you know, somewhere in the middle of the two or three meters that's mineralized there. I can't tell you exactly, but it was in the kind of the guts of the gold-bearing zone. The next two samples were from the upper horizon. They were a place about 400 or 500 meters from the first sample, a little bit more oxidized. Those samples, I think they by and large were in the gold-bearing horizon. They might have been a bit out, you know, but I think we pretty much got it. You know, it's very difficult visually to see these sometimes, but I think we got pretty close. The fourth sample was further along yet. It was about 1,200 meters east of the first sample, and that one was, again, in the upper horizon. That one, I don't think we quite, I think we were actually towards a footwall and we got into the material below it. What's remarkable is that even though that sample was lower grade, the machine worked fantastic. It managed to pick the gold, even though it was lower grade. So that's interesting. I mean, think about it. You know, we've got a deposit here, very nuggety, very hard to put your finger on exactly where the top and the bottom is. But with this, this might actually give us means to process something that has a bit of uncertainty around it, and even if it's low grade, it appears to be effective.
So is that the important part here, is that what you're proving is the TOMRA machine is effective in terms of isolating the gold nuggets within the larger deposit, or is there something more that you can pull out of these very high grades for the concentrates when comparing them to, say, the head grade?
Look, the resulting head grades are the numbers that were calculated in this most recent news release. What is encouraging, though, is that the mass of material that we produce through sorting is very small. In other words, we capture most of the gold in a small fraction. That's great because that means you can do something directly with that product. You can process it further to extract the gold. You don't have to deal with, you know, millions of tons of material at that point. You're dealing with a very, very small fraction.
Okay. The next couple of questions deal with the conglomerates and the potential continuation of these conglomerates. There's a couple questions that I'm going to combine here. One being the fact that Artemis today, or well, yesterday, released quarterly activity report saying that 3 out of 7 diamond drill holes at Purdy's did not hit the conglomerate. But there is also the question of why don't you guys go in at Comet Well, start drilling some diamond holes below the conglomerate to confirm any sort of continuation?
Okay, first of all, we have drilled a lot of diamond holes. There were some news releases in the last two quarters of the last year that show some maps where we drilled diamond holes. We are putting that data together right now. Artemis needed this data because in Australia they report quarterly results. This is just a small snippet. These 7 drill holes that we drilled over there were basically infill holes to kind of augment some drilling we did in 2017. We're fleshing out that model right now. So in short, we do have a lot of diamond drill holes at Comet Well. They demonstrate good continuity. We see the conglomerates from hole to hole. I've talked about this before. At Purdy's Reward, we needed to test a few areas where there was kind of a gap in data. And one of them was around a little island-like feature that we see. So there were a few holes, like I think you said 3, that hit this island-like body. But the rest of them hit the conglomerate. The conglomerate simply wraps around the island-like feature. What we're going to do is once we get our mineralization report put together, and which includes a geologic model of all this diamond drilling, we will put that three-dimensional model in the public's hands too, so they can see the continuity, the conglomerates, and so forth.
Okay, so in summary, we should be getting some news in terms of the continuity of the conglomerates when you do come out with some more studies and tie together some more of these work and the drill holes that have already been drilled, correct?
Correct.
Okay, now how about as well the potential of some of this gold-containing gravels at Egina, let's switch over to Egina now, being carried over to some of the other properties around what project that Novo holds? We've seen a couple of companies like Pacton Gold show some results that there could be some similar alluvial gravel deposits.
Yes, that's a good question. Obviously, you know, anybody that's gone onto Google Earth can see where we're at, where they can see that the terrace is, you know, extensive. It goes on many, many kilometers. Obviously, that means that if this hypothesis that this terrace is gold-bearing is proven true by us, then that means others might have some of this gravel as well, obviously. We decided to target where we are at because there's a lot of historic gold occurrences. In other words, proven gold in the terrace, and we've secured around 950 square kilometers, I believe, around Egina area, of which maybe half is terrace material or terrace terrain. I would say if people want to kind of do a mental evaluation of what's potential out there, go on to Google Earth. If you see hilly terrain, probably not conducive for terrace gravels. If you see, you know, these flat sheet-like areas, you know, that's more likely a target for this.
Okay, now if we take a step back and understand that about a year and a half ago is when this Karratha Gold Project story really got going, got a lot of attention. You guys were jackhammering nuggets out of the ground. How much has the story changed? How much more do you understand now? And what's your enthusiasm compared to when you started jackhammering and pulling these nuggets out?
I remain extremely enthused. I would say our eyes were open late last year when we did the work at Egina. We watched Farno McMahon, for example, digging up gold out of these gravels. That's a good question. It kind of gives you a bit of reflection. I guess if I had to put it simply, I would say we started at Comet Well and Purdy's Reward, and that's a very important area. You know, we're working hard to move that forward. But now we recognize Egina is also an important area. Same position, same conglomerates. But what's really intriguing about Egina is the fact that the gold has appeared to have weathered out of a lot of the conglomerate and been shed down onto these flats. So we have two models here. You know, we got the loose gravels as well as the conglomerates. Now, we will be doing work on the conglomerate fraction at Egina too. Going forward, we have to get permissions from the Aboriginals to explore on the reserve in that area. But we already have indications just from historical reporting that those conglomerates do contain gold. So I remain very excited. I would say we're in early days, hard as it is for some people to hear, we're still in early days in many respects in this story. It's a huge area, a lot of potential. We see the gold in these conglomerates over a vast area. That's 130 kilometers from Egina to Comet Well. So we're in early days, and by no means has our enthusiasm diminished.
Yeah, and one thing I can say is just from talking to you over these last about year and a half to 2 years is it really does seem like you're getting a better and better understanding of the way that these resources have come together, because it is very, very different and the exploration you've had to do has been very different. Can we also get an update on this MOU, the Memorandum of Understanding with Sumitomo Corporation? We got an update back at the very beginning of January, but I wanted to follow up with you if you could add some more color as to how you and Sumitomo are working together.
Certainly. Look, we've been building a relationship with Sumitomo for the past several years. Sumitomo Corporation is really a finance group. They do have a mining division, but they're a big corporation. They finance a lot of different industries. A lot of people confuse them with Sumitomo Metal Mining. That is indeed a mining company. But Sumitomo Corporation actually works in partnership with many different mining companies. For instance, Newmont. They have several interests with Newmont, Sherritt, Teck now, you know, different companies. And they are long-term partners, extremely good people. They're motivated in the same way that the companies are. In other words, they want to see production and so forth. They usually take minority positions, but they also are able to finance projects in a sustainable way going forward. So we see this partnership is very valuable. We look forward to working with them and hope to have some things in place this year.
All right, let's wrap it up here with a comment on the cash position of the company. First, what is the general cash position that Novo is sitting on? And can you give us an idea of how many of these warrants that are at 90 cents? They expire in May, so that can be another boost to the company. But about how many of those are still left outstanding?
Yeah, there's roughly 14 million still. We know whose hands they're in. I've talked to the people on a routine basis. I think we can see an orderly exercise of most of those. That will bring in, I believe, another 12-point-odd million Canadian dollars. Currently, we have about 47. You know, so we're in good position. We have plenty of money to move things forward, and very supportive shareholders who hold those warrants.
All right. What do you want to leave all of our listeners and all of the investors with? Kind of a message of what to expect, what's on deck, and what you're hoping to prove out here.
Sure. About 2 weeks ago, we put out a news release that talks about kind of the targets, the short-term targets for all of the projects. You know, this is Comet Well, as well as Egina, even Beaton's Creek. All right. We've got a lot of news coming up. A lot of people think, we're on break or something. We are not. We're working frantically right now, putting together a new model for Beaton's Creek. All right, we've got a bunch of bulk samples that are coming back. We expect maybe in the next week or so to have those results in hand. So basically what I'm saying is we have a good stream of news over the next few months. Beaton's Creek bulk samples, Beaton's Creek resource upgrade. We also are looking at other things we can talk about around Beaton's once we get that resource upgrade out. At Egina, we're developing the work plans right now. We will be starting that season, that work season, in March once the rainy season's over. At Comet Well, we've got our timer results. We're putting together mineralization reports and looking at how we would undertake trial mining. So a lot of things moving all together in a big parallel path, but we are very active. We're going to make these projects work.
All right, there you have it, an update from Quentin Henny and Novo Resources. Just a reminder, Novo is traded on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol NVO and on the OTCQX under the symbol NSRPF. In full disclosure, I am a shareholder of Novo, and if anybody has any follow-up questions, I know we didn't get to all of the questions, but please keep them coming, fleck@kereport.com. In the meantime, Quentin, have a great rest of your weekend. Everybody, thank you for tuning in to the first hour. I will be back for the second hour, focusing more on the broad U.S. equity markets and what the Federal Reserve had to say this week. Thanks, Quentin.
Thanks, Roy.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.